This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
You're van damn right. It's another episode of Junk Food Cinema here on the Blog Talk Radio Network, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com.
Dot running gag.
I am your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist. He's a screenwriter. He's my professional fight manager, as well as a lieutenant of Megaforce, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
Hi.
How is that fight managing coming? Have you booked me any fights to the death yet?
I have.
Yeah, should I not ask where they're taking place?
No, you should absolutely not ask where they're taking place or who you're fighting.
All right, so it's definitely in the parking lot of a Whole Foods, and I'm definitely fighting their sommelier, right? That's what's happening?
Probably.
That's the kind of fight I think this movie would set up. What's this movie?
It's their cheesemonger, actually.
Oh, fucking cheesemonger would be a great name for a big bad.
I am the cheesemonger!
Oh, man. It's like if Chippendale's Rescue Rangers did a version of this movie, the big bad would totally be cheesemonger.
The weird thing is, I didn't think that was where you were going, and so I got a different Chippendales in my head when you started that, which created a whole new version of the cartoon in my head that I don't want
to
see.
In the sequel to this movie, there could very well be a scene where Van Damme takes on two Chippendales dancers, because I think it would actually fit in with what this movie is doing in terms of fight construction.
Speaking of second movie, we'll get there, but I personally believe that this is in a specific cinematic universe. That this is a prequel movie for a character that we'll talk about in a little bit.
Ooh, I love it. Hey, speaking of listening to us talk, if you're interested in hearing more of what we're babbling about, you can always check out our back catalog on Blog Talk Radio or on iTunes. You can also follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, and you can like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show...
I mean,
it's the thing that makes you want to jump into that squared circle and punch another guy in a kilt. You can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema, and for as little as a dollar an episode, you get a lot of bonus content that nobody else gets to hear, and for, you know, $5 an episode or above, you actually get access to an entire fifth episode called The Deep Dish that we're actually recording this week as well, and I'm super excited about. And hey, speaking of new things for patrons, Greg McLennan and I, in service of JCV December... recorded a...
As opposing to servicing JCVD.
Which I would, given the opportunity. We recorded a commentary for Kickboxer, which is, I think, a very underappreciated John Connolly, the second of the Bloodsports, and a very underappreciated version of Bloodsport of the five that he did. So that is now available on patreon.com/junkfoodcinema for all of our patrons. And if you are following us on social media, now is a really good time to do that, because January is going to be, we're going to be calling in, I think I'm calling it the January Junk Tab.
So yeah, essentially the idea was November was Cargillvember, December was JCV December, and that was all Brian's picks.
You don't
so
say.
January is kind of your picks. We have recorded, we're getting close to like 200 episodes.
Real close to 200 episodes.
And over that time, there have been a lot of episodes where we've said the phrase, take a drink, junkies, because we intended to do an episode about that movie. Now, we've said that so many times, we don't necessarily remember which movies we've actually said it about.
Yeah.
They're movies we would actually like to cover. So what we're asking you junkies to do is to think back to your favorite episodes or your favorite mentions in those episodes of when we said take a drink, and we want you to vote and tell us which of those movies you want us to cover, because you guys are helping us program January.
Yeah, so basically go to Twitter or go to Facebook and give us your what you want us to cover of what we've talked about that we're definitely going to cover. You're calling in the tab, finally, for all those drinks. So hashtag junk tab, and we'll actually go through, and whichever movies get the most votes, those are the movies we're going to cover in January. You guys are programming Junk Food Cinema. I'm a little uncomfortable with how much power I've given you.
Yeah, except that you read me the list of the current leaders, and there's some, that would be a damn good month all its own. But I want to get some more of the junkies in there to voice their opinions on what thing we said we should cover that we should definitely cover.
We don't want to make any choices yet, so we have to let it linger out there on social media for you guys to keep making those choices. Hashtag junk tab. Really excited to see what you come up with.
And by the way, happy holidays.
Hey!
It is 2 days after Christmas. We are kicking back here in the Casa. We've got eggnog. Mm. We've got scotch.
Two things that don't have to be separate. Put your hands together,
yeah,
my friend.
Yeah, no. I made some, my first batch of legitimate eggnog in my life this year. And there was concerns by a few people that, wow, that's strong, maybe less whiskey next time. And Brian drank it, and what was the verdict?
The verdict is the answer is never less whiskey. I refuse to accept that less whiskey is the solution to any problem, and this does not require less whiskey, but at all.
No, it actually turned out really, it's Buffalo Trace eggnog, and it is fabulous.
Just like our ancestors drank, and I'm okay with that. Oh, it's delicious. And speaking of delicious, this week's movie, this is, I feel like, of JCV December, this is the main event.
It really is. This is the one that I was willing to do the entire month for. That it was.
So the rest of this month is, for Cargill, has been a concession for doing this movie.
Yes, because I've always wanted to do this movie. In fact, I remember when they first did the JCVD marathon that Greg McLennan threw. What was it called?
Van Damage.
You know, a lot of people are like, I have no idea what he's going to show. And I'm like, I know. And I called 4 out of the 5 movies of what I would program. And the one that I had in there that everyone was like, no, why would he show that? Was this movie, Lionheart.
They think they can get away with murder.
This is gasoline.
But they didn't count on one thing.
Does he have any other relatives? Anyone else that could possibly help?
Who gave up your family when you joined the Legion?
I never give up my family.
He's trained to fight for his life. Now, he's fighting for revenge.
Just tell her Joshua's here with somebody I think she'd like to meet.
Sure you want to mess up that face, handsome?
They think it's a game.
Hey, I got 3-1 against Lionheart.
He's playing for keeps. But now, he's facing the ultimate challenge.
That's him, a born killer, not some bum we picked off the street.
Well, this dude's already bathed 8 bodies.
I'll beat the guy, I have to.
The rules are simple.
There's no rules.
The stakes are high.
What I did tonight, I did for my family.
You win. You live.
Now what's it gonna be?
You lose. You die.
It's going to be simple.
Van Damme is... Lionheart.
This is one of his. This is so deep in his oeuvre, if you will allow me to.
I think that is an appropriate word to use for a French speaking actor like Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Yeah, he has a very particular plot that we've mentioned in previous episodes to a bunch of these movies. It's the whole reason I didn't want to do Kickboxer this month, is because Kickboxer is just Bloodsport, but not as good. While you say it's underrated, I agree it might be underrated, but it's not nearly as good as Bloodsport, and it sure as shit is not as good as Lionheart. Lionheart is the most nakedly manipulative of his films. It is so crass in its overt manipulation of the audience, and yet hits all the notes just right to where it is a thoroughly fucking enjoyable masterpiece of Van Damme's career. It is, I believe, his best film that is not a meta film.
This is, again, we are talking about Lionheart, aka Full Contact, aka Absent Without Leave, aka Wrong Bet, aka Leon. That last one is what it's on Amazon under the title Leon, which is the only title that doesn't make sense because it's spelled L-E-O-N, and his name in the movie is Leon, L-Y-O-N, and Harrison Page calls him Lion, L-I-O-N. No one actually calls him L-E-O-N, so it's a title that
the
doesn't
little girl
make,
does.
The little girl calls him Leon. She knows his actual name. So unless this whole movie is told from the little girl's perspective, and she's like the Red in Shawshank Redemption of this movie,
which I actually argue that she is,
that would be really interesting. It's like, I met this tall drink of water who kept doing the splits. It was very uncomfortable how much we saw his ass.
Except that we only see his ass the same amount that we generally see it in other movies. Does he do the splits?
We need to go through the Matrix, man. Every episode, we got to hit this Matrix up. So this is a movie where Jean-Claude Van Damme is playing a character named Leon Guilfort, I believe. No, that's not. He has an actual last name, Guillaume or something to that effect.
It's not that either.
It's close to that. Something in that area. The IMDb is being very withholding, but the subtitles on Amazon Prime were less so. So I know there's an actual Gaultier. It's Gaultier.
There it is.
So Van Damme is playing a character named Leon Gaultier, who, if you can believe this, because it happens in about four other Van Damme movies, is in the French Foreign Legion, and he finds out that his brother back in the States has just been the target of a...
been burned alive by a second-tier Ken Wall clone.
Yes, absolutely, which is the letter that he gets says exactly those words, which enrages him, and he decides that he has to go and be with his brother, who's in the hospital, and visit his family. But the French Foreign Legion, what do you know? They're just kind of dicks about family leave in that they don't give you any because it's the goddamn French Foreign Legion.
Well, you don't get family leave because it's technically a version of prison.
Yeah.
It's if you commit a crime, you can go to prison or you can join the Foreign Legion and do your time there serving your country, which serving France is apparently involves, you know, pounding steaks in the desert in Africa, which is a pretty shitty fucking job. And so, yeah, so they not only can he not leave, this is where this movie starts being so overtly manipulative. He has gotten a letter that his brother has been burned alive by a second-tier Ken Wall clone, and he's like, I have to go. And it's like, no, you can't go. I have to go. You are being so rude about it. And then this guy, who's more Nazi than Foreign Legion, decides he's going to fuck with him and just totally just breaks down Leon in such a way that we are totally down with him running away from what is essentially prison service to go stow away on a ship and go to America.
I feel like this is where Frank Dukes thought he was in Bloodsport, was in this French Foreign Legion camp, because he feels the need to escape when it's like, dude, you could have just left. You're like, no one's keeping you here.
So everything we talked about as being goofy and nonsensical in Bloodsport here all makes complete logical sense.
100%.
Like when there are two guys in suits chasing him down and constantly looking for him, he's an escaped convict.
Yeah.
And he's a convict that had 6 months left on a 6-year sentence and embarrassed these guys by kicking the shit out of them. And the only flaw that this movie has in its logic is the pseudo-Nazi is like when Van Damme is staggering off into the desert, they're like, well, if the desert doesn't kill him, the locals will. We should probably go and check for him down at the docks tomorrow. And if we don't find him at the docks tomorrow, we should definitely send some people to America to go look for him there. Like, there's this small disconnect of, I don't think he's really committed to the deserts or the locals will kill him.
True story.
But everything that happens from then on makes logical sense, and how he falls into everything and why he's fighting all has heart behind it.
So much heart.
So much heart that this is that little Van Damme movie that could.
It has the heart of an animal that is known for having a large heart.
Not like a cheetah or a big elephant heart.
Maybe in the cat family.
Tiger.
Yeah, tiger's not quite right.
Something.
Yeah, we've drawn this out too long. Yes. Lionheart.
Which actually his name is kind of the origin of why he's called Lionheart is actually kind of cool. So before we get there. Here's where we're going to go back in time, junkies, because once this
Wait. No, you know, the Time Enforcement Commission's already coming down on us for our last two episodes.
We're going back in time again. Leon gets to New York after he's jumped a ship. Again, really cool. Like, he's not allowed to go on the top deck, and he's like, fuck that, I'm going on the top deck. And then the ship's captain is like, I told you to get down. He sees that he's in New York, and he said, you said this was going to Los Angeles. What the fuck does it matter? You don't have a green card. You are never getting off this boat. He's been shoveling coal for weeks to get this boat across the Atlantic, and he's fucking pissed. So he kicks some ass, jumps ship, ends up in New York, and as if he had just jumped off a train, he walks into the movie Hard Times.
I believe I've been saying for many years that Lionheart is Van Damme's Rocky. I was wrong. Lionheart is Van Damme's Hard Times.
It is his Hard Times. And if you are saying what is Hard Times, either go back and listen to our episode of Hard Times or fucking watch Hard Times and then listen to that episode or just watch Hard Times.
Yeah.
Hard Times would make an amazing double feature with this because the first act of Hard Times is like minute 5 to minute 25 of this movie.
True.
And it is, if you think, hey, why would I want to watch that again? I'm going to tell you that not only is Lionheart badass, but Hard Times is James Coburn and fucking Charles motherfucking Bronson.
And the first film of motherfucking Walter Hill.
Yes.
It is
a film that if you've never seen Hard Times, watch it back to back with this because they're two very different movies about two very different guys who fall into the same racket, and it's very interesting how it works. And it's great. So then we're in Hard Times, and Leon walks up. He's broke. He needs money. He sees a street fight. He walks up. He's like, shit, I could do this.
Yeah.
And they say, what's your name, son? And he goes, Leon. Leon, fuck you, French.
This is where we need to introduce you to the character of Mr. Joshua, played by Harrison Page. I love
playing
this
James
character.
Coburn. I swear to God, he was a Hard Times fan and is like, I'm playing the James Coburn role. I'm fucking going full Coburn, but I'm also going to keep it very late 80s street.
Oh my God. I have to assume that when you look at the writers of this movie, who were in fact Van Damme and Sheldon Lettich, that a character,
the director,
yes, a character like Mr. Joshua probably improv, or that actor Harrison Page probably improvised a lot of what he was saying, because there is, and he was a classically trained Shakespearean actor, but the way he delivers lines and the breakneck speed that he is throwing quips at you, there is no way all that shit was on the page. There is absolutely no way, because he is, or if like maybe the key phrase is there, but he is embellishing it with 15 or 16 F-bombs, 15 or 16, like, it's like my favorite is when Van Damme takes the money out of his pocket after that first fight. He's like, get your fucking hands out of my pocket. Okay, go ahead. It's your money any goddamn way. And then he hands him the money, and he's just like, what, you fight pretty good, but you can't get for shit. Give me my goddamn money. And you're just like, I can't follow everything that you're saying, but you are delivering it so well. And he plays so well off of Van Damme, who in this movie, I don't know if it was just that he wasn't coached as much. This is still pseudo early in his career, or if they were trying to make a statement about this character. But in this movie, Van Damme's English is the worst of any movie he's ever been in. And he delivers sentences that they went with that take, even though they don't make any, the words don't make any fucking sense.
The thing I love about this movie, why I absolutely love it, why I think it's the best of Van Damme, is it uses all of the weaknesses of his films to their advantage. Like, rather than trying to make, you know, do the Arnold Schwarzenegger thing and try to pretend that he's from America and like almost like a why am I blanking on his name now? The Disaster Artist.
Tommy Wiseau.
Tommy Wiseau. Like, yeah. I'm from New Orleans. Like, no, you're not from New Orleans, motherfucker. Like, that is, no, you are not Cajun French. I'm sorry, Van Damme. You sound nothing like Cajun French. So because of that, because they play into the fact that he is French. He's been in a prison. He's only fighting for one thing, and that thing is this distant family of his, a family he's never really, you know, like he's got a niece he's never met. And because he's got this fight promoter who ends up putting him in cool clothes, everything about Van Damme and what Van Damme tries to do on screen totally works, because you never think, oh, Van Damme is trying to look really cool. It's like, no, he was dressed up that way by this boss that's totally sexually harassing him. We'll get to that.
Oh my God. We will get to that.
Will we get to that? His English is terrible, but of course his English is terrible. It's his second language.
But you just don't hear in other movies, even when they try to account for his Frenchness, which is in The Matrix. How do they account for him having that accent? You don't hear sentences like, don't ask too much question, and he was not enough strong to be jail. I'm not exaggerating. These are the exact words and the exact order of words that come out of Van Damme's mouth, and that's the take they use.
But that's great. That it lends an authenticity to this movie that builds that heart, because everything that works, it becomes cliche in several of these other films, totally works here. You don't need a 15-minute montage of why he cares about this guy and needs to fight for honor, because it's a fucking little girl and, you know, his sister-in-law. Like, and he loved his brother, and we watched the horrible way his brother died, and then we learned that his brother's a piece of shit, and that this woman and her daughter doesn't deserve that. And so he's fighting for them, and you're like, I'm in. I see why he needs to win all these fights and why he has to fight. This isn't about honor, or it isn't about looking cool, and it's not about winning a fucking sword for your dead master. It's fucking about making money so that a mom doesn't have to work at an apple processing plant. And when I mean apple processing plant, I mean she puts apples in boxes.
Can you imagine if she, like, if today it was like, oh, she works for Apple, you'd be like, well, then she should be fine. It's like, no, she literally, like, boxes up apples.
Yeah,
like,
and it's this little girl.
This is pre-iPhone, guys.
Yeah, they're about to be evicted, and so he starts fighting for money for them. And you give a shit. And the thing is that everything that the black hole of charisma that he has whenever he's trying to be cool melts away the minute he's not trying to be cool. There are several actors who are like that, and he's one of them. Whenever he lets his guard down, he becomes a real actor. And we're actually talking about that this week in our deep dish when we actually cover JCVD for JCV December.
Yeah. But if you say that too much, you will open an actual wormhole that swallows everything, including Ron Silver. So yes, gotta be careful with
that. But this is one of those movies where all of that works for him, and that all of these subplots that are always in these movies are actually woven together in a way that drives the story rather than is a distraction from it.
True.
Or even, you know, works against it. You know, there's no Mentos commercial here. Like, they have the same running chase scene, but it turns into a fight, and then he kicks their ass, and then, you know, his boss's, you know, right-hand man shows up and is like, get in the fucking car, like, and helps him get away, and in a way that makes sense and moves the plot along. Like, this movie works all the way through. Like, for those of you that have been listening to me kind of try very hard to find things that I like about some of these other Jean-Claude Van Damme movies,
holding back your disdain the way Van Damme has to hold back his accent sometimes.
I don't think I've actually held back my disdain.
Has his accent been held back. You can see correct. Why that metaphor works, Cargill.
This one does not need that at all. This is a movie where if you're like, I'm not big into Jean-Claude Van Damme, I don't dislike him, this is the movie you need to watch to go, yes, I love this movie, and this is everything Jean-Claude Van Damme was supposed to be. I saw this in a theater when it came out, in a mall theater, and I was the only person in the theater on a Saturday afternoon seeing it, because at this point people had given up on Van Damme movies.
Wow. Like 2 years into his career, they'd already given up. That's
yeah,
insane.
And then he was brought back by the bigger budget movies. Mm-hmm. But these, he had a string of movies. He and Seagal were each putting out a string of movies that were increasingly more obnoxious. And he had done Cyborg the year before, which I also saw in a theater, and we have not slotted in this month for a reason.
Yeah.
That and your personal disdain for Albert Pune.
Albert Pune, yeah.
Director of 54 feature films.
Director and films are both very kind words to use in that sentence.
But this movie's fucking legit. And so what we've set up, that is the setup for what then follows as a series of interesting fights that are what I've always considered the Street Fighter movie that I always wanted.
Before,
and he made a Street Fighter movie.
You're absolutely right. It's funny that this is the Street Fighter movie that he should have done when he did an actual Street Fighter movie. Speaking of, by the way, the one plot point that I think gets brushed over, but I think is so interesting and important to this, is that the whole reason that Van Damme is in that Legionnaire camp is because he took the rap for his brother.
Yeah, and the reason why the brother's wife, the sister-in-law, hates him is because she thinks Leon is the one that got her husband hooked on drugs and in the drug trade. And really, he was just taking the fall for his brother because he didn't believe his brother would survive jail or not strong.
He was not. Oh, my God. I have to say this again.
Say it again, my friend.
He was not enough strong to be jail.
He was not enough strong to be jail.
He was not enough strong to be jail.
And because he was not enough strong to be jail, he took the fall and ended up in Northern Africa for 5.5 years doing time for his brother, and then risks lifetime incarceration just to go see the burnt ashes in a fucking hospital.
Yeah, and by the way, that's a very impressive Legionnaire camp, because not only is one of the guards who follows him to America to chase him down, the guard Mustafa, is Michael Kesey, who also played Tong Po in Kickboxer, although he looks nothing like Tong Po in this movie at all.
No, not at all.
A random Legionnaire who gets his ass kicked by Van Damme at the camp, Billy Blanks. Really impressive lineup of people that he's fighting at this Legionnaire camp to get to America. And once he gets here, he meets up with Harrison Page. And the number two of the female boss that you're talking about is played by Brian Thompson, the bad guy from Cobra. And, by the way, the bad guy in the second Mortal Kombat movie. And Van Damme totally does the Johnny Cage dick punch in this film.
Oh,
so
yeah.
A lot of interesting connective tissue. I also just noticed this, Cargill. I'm assuming that when you talk about him being brought back by big movies, you have to kind of put Universal Soldier in 92 as like the turning
yes.
point.
Yes.
Okay, between Bloodsport and Universal Soldier, which is from 1988 to 90, so 4-year period, he made, before Universal Soldier, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 movies in a 4-year period.
Yes. And only, they got to a point that only people like me were going to see them. And even eventually I gave up, like, you know, but that was much later because Van Damme and early, mid Van Damme and early Seagal was really, they were our replacements for what had happened to Arnold and Sly.
Yeah.
Arnie and Sly had started making movies that had too big of budgets and started, you know, having those issues. And occasionally we'd get something like Terminator 2 out of Arnie, but most of the time, you know, some of those films weren't all that fucking great.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the late 80s, very early 90s when both of them start experimenting with comedy? When you have Stop and My Mom Will Shoot, Kindergarten Cop, where both of our action icons suddenly decided they were funny.
To be fair, have you ever heard the story of Stop or My Mom Will Shoot, why he did it?
Yeah.
For those of you that aren't aware, Arnold and Sly are very good friends. In fact, if I remember correctly, they went in together on Planet Hollywood. Like they along with Bruce Willis.
Along
are the
with Jean-Claude Van Damme, by the way.
And so they loved fucking with each other and pranking each other. And so Arnold thought it would be funny to see if he could get Sly attached to this terrible script that was floating around called Stop or My Mom Will Shoot. So he told his agent that he was interested in it. And of course, once that interest happened, Sly was like, oh, fuck no, I'm not letting him have this movie. So Sly forced his way in and fought with Arnold, and Arnold politely backed away. And he's like, now I'm making this fucking movie. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is, oddly enough, as a prank, responsible for an entire fucking terrible movie existing. I think that's glorious.
It's the Hollywood equivalent of when you're at a white elephant and you have a gift you don't want and you try to play it up so that somebody else steals it from you. He pulled that in Hollywood.
Yeah, when was the last time you did a white elephant?
Like 2 days ago.
Oh, gee, well, wonder where that was.
I don't know, some wretched hive of scum and villainy.
Oh, here.
Alias Junk Food HQ, alias your living room. Yes. But what I find so interesting about that is that if we were to do an episode on the Expendables, I just realized that the junk food pairing would be Captain Crunch crusted chicken fingers, which was something on the menu at Planet Hollywood, because that movie is basically just filled with Planet Hollywood investors more than anything else.
It really, really fucking is.
It's the full circle of the opening day of the first Planet Hollywood. They had like 100 locations at one point, and then they had one in like Singapore, and then they just started like, I think the only one that's left is in Orlando, because that's where a lot of things go to die, is Florida. So let's talk about the...
Oh, you know what? We blew totally past. So I wanted to stress the interesting thing of how Lionheart gets the name Lionheart.
Oh, yes.
So he's Leon. He introduces himself as Leon. And then the guy who becomes his manager is like, Leon, what are you, fuck you, French, Leon, Lion, the Lion.
Yeah.
And so he starts pipping him as the Lion at fights. And then he brings him to somebody who's does the rich people circuit. Now, keep in mind, this movie contextually might not make a lot of sense to those of you watching it for the first time. It might seem weird, but you got to understand the times that MMA did not exist in 1990. If you wanted to watch two dudes fight without specific rules on the type of fighting they could use, it didn't exist. It only existed in video games. Like, you had to watch movies for that kind of stuff. Everything was very regulated with like boxing and things like that. Kickboxing and various, professional wrestling. Like, you'd have these very specific types of fights, but putting two guys in a ring who don't look like they belong together and just watching them duke it out didn't exist. So the idea of an underground fighting circuit totally made sense in 1990. And so here is the rich people circuit, where they watch high-end fights between really badass top-tier fighters and bet lots of money on it. And when the Lion is brought, she's like, the Lion? That's a fucking stupid fucking name. And then she's like, Lionheart. And so Leon becomes the Lion, which becomes Lionheart, which is the American title of the movie.
Now, this character who gives him the name Lionheart, the boss lady, who for a while in the movie is just referred to as the lady.
The Harvey Weinstein of fucking fight promoters.
Yeah, I just wanted us to sit with that for a second. It's true, but it's still.
Come up to my hotel room. Hey, you fell asleep and you just looked uncomfortable, so now you're naked under the covers.
Yeah.
And I'm just here working out, and hey, let's get you, I had your clothes burned, and we'll take you shopping. And of course, it's in that sequence. Of course, he covers up. Because he doesn't want to get out of bed and have her see it, so that he can walk into the bathroom alone so he can do his butt shot for us and not her.
Yeah.
So we get the butt shot.
But that butt shot is for us.
It's for us.
It's
our butt shot. It's not for anyone in the movie.
She can't have it. It's our butt shot. So cross that one off the matrix. We've got someone to avenge. We got the fighting tournament. And we've got the butt shot.
Well, you know, the beauty of this movie, I think, is that this
not the booty of this movie, which is the one we just saw on Van Damme.
The beauty of this movie is that there is no revenge in this movie. They set it up in the first act that, yeah, nobody knows who did this to your brother. We see who did it. And the movie doesn't fucking care who did it, because we're never going to get revenge for that character. We're not getting revenge. What we're doing in this entire movie is raising money to take care of a down and out single mother and her daughter.
Yeah.
Like, there is no revenge in this movie.
I guess that's true. Yeah, he comes to America because of something that happened to his brother, but it's not revenge that he's getting. It's actually practical support that he's lending to this family.
It's what really works about this movie, because, you know, the whole revenge thing, a lot of times, you know, revenge movies are great. You know, I love revenge movies.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, sometimes it's like, dude, you kind of got revenge like 8 dudes ago. slow your fucking roll. you know, but then, you know, then there's movies like Rolling Thunder where it's like, oh no, all of these people need to die.
Yeah.
But in this case,
they ain't got no right to live, Major.
It's not about anger. It's entirely about fighting to survive. So the meta, but you know,
but not the Stan Bush fight to survive.
No, but more in a way that is, you know, very much not a super thinly veiled metaphor for what most Americans go through, you know, just trying to make ends meet, and what awful thing that we do that we don't want to do for a living will we do to make sure our family's taken care of.
And let's delve into that metaphor a little bit, because that is very much at the heart of Lionheart, which is that this is a movie that takes it to class elitism, just gently takes it to the 1%. And I don't know that Sheldon Lettich knows how gentle that admonition is. I think he thinks he's making On the Waterfront. But this movie has really got kind of a gentle approach to talking about you know, the differences, the vast differences in living experience between the rich and the poor. And mostly that is communicated through the fight areas, the platforms, the fighting levels of this Street Fighter game, if you will. I mean, let's think about it. The first fight is in a parking garage surrounded by luxury cars. In fact,
the first fight of this movie happens under a bridge.
Yes, because she's not involved.
Yes, surrounded by a bunch of hooting and hollering broke people.
Yeah, yeah, hard times.
It's pure hard times.
He enters the movie in hard times, and then once Cynthia, otherwise known as the lady, gets involved, she starts putting him in fights that are clearly. She's basically like Calvin Candy at this point. She's staging these fights just for exploitation. And the first fight that she stages is in a parking garage surrounded by luxury cars. In fact, in one scene, the Mercedes-Benz logo is very prominent. That's the fight where he ends up taking on
Scotsman.
Rowdy Roddy Piper comes into the fucking fray. And
Not really Rowdy Roddy Piper.
But, I mean, Rowdy Roddy Piper was Canadian. So, I mean, anybody could really be Rowdy Roddy Piper. So that fight ends up, that's actually a pretty good fight. His audition fight, which I think is also in a parking garage, he does the Johnny Cage dick punch and it's over in about 5 seconds. But this is the first like real fight. He goes toe to toe with the Scotsman and takes him out. Then we have a fight on a racquetball court. And it's like, okay.
With something akin to a professional wrestler.
Yeah. It looks like a Hacksaw Jim Duggan type. His name comes up a lot more these days than I ever thought it would.
Yeah.
And
I love Hacksaw Jim Duggan.
And then the third fight is in a half full swimming pool
With
a mall ninja, capoeira in a singlet kind of situation.
You almost want him to stop and pull out a katana and some ninja stars and go, while you were studying the kick, I was studying the blade. Like, he's just, I mean, that guy is so terrible 1990s. I'm trying, like, he's the only villain in the movie that I just detest for the sake of being pathetic. Like, every shot, he's like looking into the camera, like, this is my big movie. And, but in a way that he's like, I'm so fucking cool. Oh, here, I'm going to scramble down the side to the wall. I'm still fucking cool. Now yeah. I'm in the pool. I'm so fucking, and it's like, dude, this guy was either a heavy metal douchebag or a fucking mall ninja. Like, this guy, I knew a billion of these guys growing up, and none of them turned out okay. So, but yeah, so he's in a half full pool.
Yeah, he's in a half full. And by the way, you mentioned him coming down from the hill. Did you ever see that Burt Lancaster movie, The Swimmer? I wonder if that's what this mall ninja is doing, where he's just running through the valley. Anywhere there's a swimming pool, he's just running from pool to pool to fight because he can't possibly go home and face how terrible his life has become. There may be a far more interesting movie going on that we don't know about with this mall ninja. Him just having to go from pool to pool to fight so that he hides out from his miserable existence. But then again, maybe he's just a heavy metal douchebag, which is funny because he also looks like, what's that band that did that song, I'm the one who wants to
Extreme.
Yeah, he looks like the fucking lead singer.
Oh wait,
of Extreme.
No. That was Mr. Big.
Mr. Big.
Yeah,
that's the one I'm thinking. He looks like the fucking lead singer, Mr. Big.
You feel it. Feel it too.
He may in fact be
on a line of
waiting, holding on.
was
yeah.
just to be the next to fight with you.
Yes, yes, yes. This is what I'm talking about. He may actually be Mr. Big himself. We're not entirely sure. There are layers to this mall ninja that were unexplored in the movie, and that is why we need to have a Lionheart 2, an AWOL 2, a Wrong Bet 2. By the way, Wrong Bet, that line in the last fight when Joshua tells him that he's bet all the money against Leon, he's like, I didn't think you could beat Attila. I bet all the money against you, so you're getting your ass kicked. Just stay down. It's fine. We're going to be rich. And Van Damme just looks at him and goes, Wrong Bet. And I remember in my head at that time thinking, wow, that would have been a cool name for this movie too. And then during my research, it was in some places the actual fucking name of this movie.
Yeah. And of course that leads to the greatest moment of this movie, the moment that will, you know, separate the men from the boys on whether or not you love this movie. One of the people who's bet on Van Damme just starts clapping.
Oh.
And it's not, it doesn't become a slow clap. It's just they're clapping. It's this steady clap, clap, and people start joining in. And then the two guys, one of the guys of the two guys who was sent after him to bring him back as a Legionnaire, starts clapping because at this point he has gotten pummeled into the dirt and he will not go down. He refuses to go down. This is yet another example of just how much heart Lionheart has. This motherfucker won't go down. He will not go down. He is fighting a brutal motherfucker, and he will not go down, even though he knows this guy will probably kill him, as he has killed 8 other people in the ring. Because, spoiler warning, he's been set up. People have been hoodwinked. They think they're going to watch Lionheart kick the shit out of this guy.
Out of Mutton Chop the Hun.
Yeah, well, he's kind of like, why am I blanking on his name? Lemmy from Motorhead.
Okay, yeah.
Had a kid with Andre the Giant. That's who the boss of this movie looks like. Everyone, it's like Andre the Giant had a kid with Lemmy. And
you win some, you lose some. It's all the same to
and
me.
And he's got a cat. And this guy...
He's got a fucking cat. And he's got a cat. Why not?
And by the way, interesting thing, the guy goes over to stroke his cat in the middle of the fight after he's beaten up on Van Damme a bit. Just, that's how he shows off. Like, that's his big show-off move. Rather than looking at the odds going, ah, he walks over and he pets his cat. It's an interesting little moment. But so people start clapping, and one of the guys chasing him is starting to clap. And oh my God, at that moment, if you're not with it and excited to watch Van Damme,
check your pulse. Shit,
check your pulse, because you might not be an action movie fan.
No, because you might not be alive.
You might not be.
God, if your heart is beating, it has to bleed for this character who's only doing this because the brother who set him up to be in jail in the first place gets burned by his own Ken Wall clones, drug cronies, and Van Damme feels an obligation to take care of the family he's never known and who hates him in the first fucking place.
You know what? That opening scene always reminds me of Streets of Fire. Now, yeah. And so, like, with Streets of Fire and Hard Times, I can't help but think that Lionheart might be this director's love letter to Walter Hill.
I would believe it in a heartbeat. I would,
and especially the way they go, like very warriors like with the villains, where every villain is different and is very showy. I mean, that also just may be drawing from the WWF, which was really big at the time. Kind of drawing from that whole concept of, well, these are like professional wrestlers. But yeah, you are in it for that ending. Then from the time the clap starts, that movie does not stop tugging at your fucking heartstrings.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
And it delivers everything. This movie is manipulative as fuck, but it delivers on everything it promises if you go with the manipulation. If you're not one of those people who's just going to sit there going, oh, they're trying very hard. Yeah, they're trying really hard, but you know what? They're actually succeeding. And it's working. And yes, the score is overwrought and telling you what you're supposed to feel.
But that's the thing, is the score is so, like, they had like an eighth of a full film score and they held on to that shit, because through most of this movie, it's not the beautiful score you hear at the end. No. It is the many moods of sexy saxophone.
Yes,
through most of the, in fact, if I may divulge sidebar into another segment of Unfiltered Fiancé, I was watching this movie tonight. She was in the other room, and I'm watching a scene, and that saxophone is in full swing, and she just yells out from the other room, and all, like, legitimate question, are you watching porn? And I was like, no, I'm watching Lionheart. I promise you it's not porn. But that saxophone, I can see why she was confused. And they hold on to that. That beautiful score that you hear at the end is, like, peppered through in little moments throughout. And then it just, like, they just unleash that shit at the end. When he's come out of that car, when those, at the end of this movie, which, okay, sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself. This final fight with Attila brought into light something that had been going on through the whole movie, maybe more so than any other Van Damme movie. There is a lot of fighting in jeans in this movie.
Yeah,
so
in fact, that
much
was
denim.
In Unfiltered Wife, an episode of Unfiltered Wife, Unfiltered Wife looked up because she was listening to the movie while she was on her phone because she walked in like two-thirds the way through and just decided to cuddle up on bed with me and watch the rest of the movie and then got on her phone. She's like, Jean-Claude Van Damme's just kicking people. And she like looks up and goes, wait, why are they wearing pants? And I'm like, oh, really? No, she's like, no, why are they fighting in jeans? And I'm like, it's just a thing they do in this movie.
I have a theory about this. That remember when I said that Sheldon Lettich thinks he's making On the Waterfront? He thinks his social message is so strong in this movie that his commentary on society is on point. Van Damme is literally wearing the armor of the working class, and by that I mean denim, because not only is he fighting in jeans...
And by that you mean Chuck Norris karate jeans.
Yes, and not only...
With the extra leg, the extra crotch room for
sure,
kicking.
Sure, yes, for kicking, and for his Van Dong.
Which, by the way, they really do have pronounced in a single shot. Like, you often get Jean-Claude Van Butt Cheeks. You don't often get the Jean-Claude Van Dong. But here, you get it in during one of the dressing scenes. Not full dong, but in we're trying to make it look like we got a lot going on down there.
No, for sure, for sure. You see, you definitely see his double impacts. No, but he's also wearing a denim jacket in some of the... So he's wearing a full Canadian tuxedo in some of these fights. And if you notice, his opponent, Attila, is wearing slacks and, like, dress shoes in that final fight, is taking place on a tennis court. Concrete, sadly. I prefer my kumite on clay. But it's on a concrete tennis court, just to kind of emphasize
kumite,
this whole...
Kumite. Kumite.
That was the one thing missing is somebody... No, it's not missing. That's what that fucking slow clap is.
Yes.
It's the kumite of this movie.
It's the kumite of this movie.
So that final fight is on a tennis court. Van Damme is in the armor of the working class, the denim, the Canadian tuxedo, and Attila the Hun is wearing dress slacks and dress shoes. I mean, that's as poignant, I think, as this movie gets. I mean, they don't really hit upon it too hard, but like it's there. It is definitely... And this character of Cynthia... As we talked about, the Weinstein of this movie is definitely sexually harassing Van Damme to the point that he's like,
holy shit,
I don't want to live in this fancy ass penthouse you got me anymore. I want to live in a shitty apartment in LA because...
Holy God, is it shitty.
It's a super shitty apartment.
Like, this is one of the things that impresses me about the movie. Like, what he thinks he's doing, he scores at a couple of times in that if you've ever been poor and lived in a shitty apartment... The key to telling how shitty the apartment is whether or not there are scratches on the wall next to where the couch goes. And this, when you look behind the couch of this one, it is just the entire wall is scratched because of the amount of shit and the amount of people who have been up and down off that couch. And the walls are punched in and scratched and the screen door is hanging off in a way that... What doesn't look like it was set up that way, in a way that it looks like they told the locations department, just find me a shitty apartment we can rent for a few days where they only will take cash and don't need to see any identification. That's the place we're looking for, and they fucking found it in LA.
100%. And it's so shitty that I half expected a stoned Brad Pitt to be smoking weed out of a honey bear right there on the couch. But unfortunately, it's
apartment's shittier than that.
Yeah. Hey, speaking of things in this movie that we love and other things that we need to address, there is one scene in this movie that I feel like if they were to ever remake would probably immediately get excised. There's a scene in this movie where Jean-Claude Van Damme is off somewhere and he's coming back toward the apartment, and it's kind of a wide shot. You see him crossing the street, and they pull in close to Joshua, who is full on eating an entire box of KFC, and it's just like, no, Sheldon, you can't, none of this is okay. You shouldn't have, this scene should be cut. Someone needs to edit this. And unfortunately, that editor was too busy completely flubbing the let's try on clothes montage scene, which is hacked to pieces. Like, if you ever want to see an example of what bad editing is, and a lot of this movie is edited very well, but you have to talk about this scene where it starts with seeing Van Damme's ass. She's totally leering at him naked, all the sexual harassment. He's got so many complaints to file with HR. And then he says, you know, I didn't ask for any of this. And he doesn't even get the full word this out of his mouth before they smash cut to like a hard rock song as we're trying on clothes and we're in this fancy place like it's Pretty Woman. And then,
yeah, no, that cut where, because he literally says, why are you being so nice to me?
That's the line, yeah.
And then hard cut and we're trying on clothes. And it's like, why did you not just cut that line?
Yeah.
Like, you cut right before that line. Like, that doesn't make any fun. Like, you don't ask a question and then just go into, now we're in a montage. Even Rocky had a montage.
But then they turn down the rock music. It becomes diegetic in the scene where he's still trying on clothes. And then that smash cuts to dinner where they're like having another conversation. That's one question that doesn't really get answered. Smash cut to the hallway. Smash cut to Joshua. It's just like, this scene is so unimportant that you're snipping it down to the barest of Aristotelian, like, snippets. Like, just get rid of it. Get rid of all of this. None of this really matters, other than this is establishing later why his wardrobe changes. I didn't need the Pretty Woman montage. You could have just told me she bought him new clothes.
I actually really like the Pretty Woman montage. No, I do, because it really defines our villain without, like, she never strokes a cat and cackles and talks about, you know, how she's going to destroy everything. It's, you see her go from giving him the hard press, and she's a rich, beautiful woman who men do not say no to. And he says no, and not only no, but I don't want to live in this nice place. I want a shitty house or apartment. You know, I need a hard life because I've got a train. And she gets so bent out of shape that she goes off just like a crazy person would, right down to the, oh, and you owe me for all those clothes, to where you're like, oh, fuck her. She doesn't have to do, like, she's, that sequence leads us to hate her the whole movie. So when we have that final turn where we see that she's going to screw him over and bet on his opponent and stack the deck to make it look like his opponent is not as good, even though everyone on the circuit he's from knows that he's like just king shit of fuck mountain.
He is Fuck Mountain.
That they're going to come and pump all this money into this, and she's going to bet on him, even though he's a fighter from her circuit.
Interesting bit of trivia. Andre the Giant's, the other nickname he could have chosen for the WWF, Fuck Mountain.
There it is.
Decided on Andre the Giant.
So that sequence really does set, like, all that sexual harassment and all of that. It's not like it is in most movies. Where you have to look at the historical context and go, all right, yeah. So in this sequence, when Bill Murray is chasing his fellow camp counselor around the office, the cabin and smacking her ass, that's what flirting in the 70s was supposed to be.
You're still supposed to like
and
the guy.
It's, I mean, honestly, it's why I can't watch Meatballs anymore. I fucking hate that I can't watch Meatballs, but that movie, that even watching that movie in this day will get you slapped with a sexual harassment suit. Like, it's bad. But this is set up in a way. Keep in mind, this is also just post sexual harassment being a thing in the mainstream. Like, the Clarence Thomas hearings have just happened the year prior, and sexual harassment is a thing the country's woken up to and still won't do anything about for almost 20 years. And
how's that coming, by the way?
Honestly, it's going really well. We experienced a huge cultural shift this year.
Yeah, as of this year.
As of 2017, finally people are like, hey, maybe this isn't okay.
That was my point.
Yeah, but it's like, we knew it wasn't okay before, but now we're really not okay with it. Like, we no longer think that having talent will allow us to look the other way. It has been a massive cultural shift and a great thing for this fucking country. But yeah, but so I feel like this movie is like trying to be aware of that as well. And again, using the rich versus poor. And the reason why I think it was okay in 1990 was it was a woman sexually harassing a man and him saying no. And so it just fucking works.
Well, that, and it's established that the person doing it is not a likable character. Like, I think that's the difference too.
And they also establish that she does it to other people. Like, well, we see just in the way she handles her previous fighter that Van Damme nutshotted.
Yeah.
Also, one of the other small points of contention in this movie, he nutshots a guy. The guy kicks, he goes down, he nutshots him, the guy goes over, and apparently they're still talking about this fight in the New York circuit. It's like, what fight? Like, they literally paid their money, and a guy, they dance around for 30 seconds, a guy kicks, a guy nutshots him, and he's down for the count. It's like, yeah, they're still talking about it because they got ripped the fuck off. What a shitty fucking fight to lose money on.
The almost fight between him and the bystander is more interesting than the fight that actually occurs.
Yeah. And one of the other things, the metaphors are not thin in this movie, where a rich girl gets splattered with blood and giggles and then takes a little of the fighter's blood and licks it because, you know, she has a taste for blood.
Hey-o. It represents obviousness.
Yes. It is metaphorical for the obviousness of this movie. Yeah. Okay, so I want to talk about, I think this movie fits into a certain cinematic universe.
Let's do it. Let's get to this theory.
So this movie's really about this little girl. This is a prequel. This is an origin story. And this little girl still grows up poor. He doesn't make a lot of money. He's done with fighting. He's made a bunch of money off the fight, but he's not set for life. So, you know, she grows up. She moves to New York City because she fucking hates LA. They wanted to get out of town. Moves to New York City. And in her 20s, she still hasn't made it. And she becomes a waitress.
Oh, my God. I knew this is where this was going. God.
So she's a waitress in New York City when all of these aliens suddenly attack in 2012. And the city is covered in aliens. This waitress is about to be killed. And in comes Captain America. And Captain America saves this particular waitress. Yeah, are you looking at it? You're looking it up. And
I knew, because I had actually looked up her filmography before this, and I knew that's, and I was like, oh, that's her. It's the same actress. Ashley Johnson, who plays the little girl in this movie, is also the waitress in The Avengers.
Who gives the tearjerker movie of The Avengers. Yeah. Like, Avengers doesn't have a tearjerker movie moment until you get to that point where she just starts talking about Captain, you know, The Avengers and God bless Captain America. And just, that's the moment where you're just, like, struggling to fight back tears. And, you know, she's got, like, 30 seconds to a minute of screen time, but she is now in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I think that de facto makes Jean-Claude Van Damme's Leon, aka Lionheart, an early superhero in the Marvel Universe.
I mean, if there was ever a name that sounds like a fucking superhero,
it's fucking Lionheart
for sure. Now, see, now what I want to do, and it's very irresponsible, but I think I'm going to go ahead and do it anyway, is I want to jump into our time machine. I want to go back in time to when they were casting at the very least, the 1990 Captain America movie. And instead of the raw star power of somebody like J.D. Salinger's kid, what if Albert Pune, who was supposed to direct this movie, ends up putting in his Captain America movie Jean-Claude Van Damme? Jean-Claude Van Damme as Captain America, which I know what you're going to say. The accent, it makes no sense. Keep in mind, in Street Fighter, he's playing Colonel Guile, a dyed-in-the-wool, red, white, and blue American with the American flag tattooed on his bicep, who's about as fucking American as a Belgian waffle.
He, you know, the thing, one of the reasons we're not covering Street Fighter is because he gives the single most incomprehensible speech in the history of film since Sylvester Stallone's sobbing speech in at the end of First Blood. Like, you, if you can understand three words from that speech, congratulations, because no one else can.
If you can recognize words that aren't "on my boat" in that speech. By the way, I kind of fucking love that speech. I understand what you're saying, and you're not entirely wrong, but I'm going to kick his ass so hard, the next Bison wannabe is going to feel it, is like, when I was a kid, that was like my fucking Patton. That was my Patton moment.
Yeah, and that movie killed Raul Julia and took him away from us. So.
I think you could argue stomach cancer killed him, but yeah.
Where do you think he got stomach cancer from? A movie this bad?
For his whole life, cigars, I would imagine.
I want to go back in time just like 2 minutes and talk about Ashley Johnson again real quick. Because, yeah, we mentioned that she, you know, was the, you know, the waitress in the movie. She's done a bunch of things since, but she's done something actually big in nerd culture, which a bunch of you probably know. She's the voice of Ellie in The Last of Us.
Yeah.
Which is an Austin connection, by the fucking way. I just thought, I didn't want to just paint her as just being the waitress. She's been an actor. She does a bunch of voice work. She's done a bunch of TV stuff. The moment that everyone knows Ashley Johnson from is she's that waitress that just fucking tugs at your heartstrings, just as she does in this fucking movie. Because holy God, is the little girl, is she just so fucking adorable. She's just like, oh, she's so cute. She's like a little fucking puppy of a kid.
Yeah.
Like, it's crazy how adorable. And when she starts screaming, no, don't go away, we need you. Like, when she's calling after, like, you could see the guy, the Legionnaires who come to get him, kind of get visibly uncomfortable at, like, fuck, dude. Like,
see, and that's crazy, because I think the moment they should have been uncomfortable is when they're watching Van Damme watch her go to school, and he's wearing a, like, sweatshirt and sweatpants. I'm of the opinion that sweatpants should not be allowed, in accordance with Megan's Law, within 300 feet of an elementary school. Because there's just something not right about following a little girl to school and wearing sweatpants. I have issues with it. But that final fight...
Going to the strip club in sweatpants, that's wrong.
Wait, that's wrong?
That's wrong.
I have some notes
to make. It's gross.
I have some notes to make in my personal mantra book. That final fight with Attila, which is so fucking good, because it really does emphasize what the very first fights in this movie do not, is the back and forth, where Van Damme is getting his ass pummeled. Like, he is getting beaten to the effect that you're almost with Joshua. You're like, please, for the love of God, stay down. He's getting Balboa in four.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, no, that's, and again, that's one of the elements that really works for this movie, is unlike other movies where, you know, the villain cheats, like
Bolo Young throwing the dust in the eyes.
Because a lot of them are very, a lot of his arch nemeses are, they're mustache twirling.
Yeah.
And they don't win fair. You know, they're not trying to win fairly because they don't think they can. This guy has no doubt he can win fairly and doesn't fucking cheat at all and gives Van Damme every chance to tap out. And Van Damme won't fucking tap out. And so he keeps pummeling him. It's almost, you almost start feeling bad for him when Van Damme comes back. And then you remember, oh shit, no, I watched video of this guy breaking a dude's back. I know that this guy has put 8 different guys in the ground. This guy kills his opponents. And he's being nice to Van Damme, but he's not a good fucking dude. And that guy needs to be taken down a peg. And so then it's like, okay, yeah, no, I could totally enjoy this again. Like, if the movie is just so good at that without overtly reminding you of, hey, think of this. It just does these small little things that make you go, oh shit, yeah, no, fuck. It's really, yeah, fuck that guy.
Yeah.
And then when everybody in that movie gets their comeuppance, and then you have a redemption story going on in a small thing in the background with the Legionnaires, where they're fuckers at the beginning. And they really, really want to get Van Damme and bring him back because they're fucking sinister.
The guy who's not the actor who played Tong Po in Kickboxer kind of looks like the Nazi mechanic from Raiders of the Lost Ark. Like, if that guy, like, instead of getting, you know, stationed at the airstrip in the desert, was just at this Legionnaires camp, and then he's chasing, like, he has a spitting image of that guy from Raiders of the Lost Ark. I was waiting for a propeller to come along and take him out. But then, you know, after that fight, he's won. And this is a moment where I think the wardrobe actually is of benefit to the fight choreography, because you believe one kick can really floor Attila, because it's not a kick with a bare foot. It's a kick with a Dickies work boot on Van Damme. That's like, holy shit. I can't imagine knowing my name again for the rest of my life if someone kicked me with that work
boot. You've ever had your hand stepped on by a Dickies work boot? Yeah, you're feeling that right now. Ah. And that's on accident.
Yeah.
Like, imagine that motherfucker trying to stamp that fucking hand.
Ow. Yeah. But instead of your hand, it's your face, and it's a flying spin kick because it's fucking Van Damme. So after that fight, the Legionnaires are taking him away. His family is good. They have all the money they could ever need. They're going to be able to get out of L.A., go somewhere, start a better life. And Van Damme is the honorable person, so he's going with the Legionnaires. And they just stop about a block away, and they're like, get out. They're deciding to give him a pass and let him go. And when he comes running up that hill back to the apartment, and that music swells, and that little girl's the first one to see him, I don't give a shit who you are. I don't give a shit if you're more of a Seagal guy or not an action guy at all. And by the way, if you're more of a Seagal guy, you should probably seek counseling. If you watch this scene and you don't like get a little bit choked up, I have to question you as a person just in general, because it is the closest Van Damme had come up to that point, or up until the mid-2000s, to having real emotional depth in a movie.
Yeah.
And this fucking movie scores that
so
well.
It's so weird that you don't see another role with that kind of emotional depth for years in his career. Like, he becomes, as I've talked about several times this month, he becomes in several movies a black hole of charisma. And they play that, they use it to really good effect in a movie we should have fucking talked about this month and just for some reason didn't consider it, because it's two big stars that are two of our favorites in the same movie. Don't think of it as a Jean-Claude Van Damme movie, but should have probably done Universal Soldier this month.
Yes, we should have done Universal Soldier.
But you know
I get
what?
It.
Take a drink. We will do Universal Soldier next year, I promise. We will do another Van Damme movie.
That movie probably just got 5 more votes now on the hashtag junk tab situation.
Hey,
for
you
next
know what?
Month.
If you're really excited, if you want us to do more Van Damme, if you are not Van Damme'd out, then by all means, put fucking Universal Soldier on there.
If you have not taken enough points of Van Damage, then I highly encourage you to put on your list Universal Soldier.
I'm really excited about the number of people who said Bad Boys 2.
Yes, well,
because we've owed that for a long time.
Very true. But yes, this movie has, you know, that great ending with all of the heart in the world, and you get the warm and fuzzies and the fight. And we haven't really hit upon this too much, but the fights in this movie are all great.
They
like,
are.
They are really well edited. They're really like real well choreographed.
Well, and what's really great about them is, unlike several of his other films, again, this is playing to his strengths and not his weaknesses. He's not trying to look like the cool guy in this movie. So he never does anything that is making him cooler than everybody else. All the fights are brutal, and he wins them by having more tenacity than his opponent and occasionally being smarter than his opponent.
Yes.
But he does not win by some cool, I just did the splits and did a punch. And then one thing I was surprised he never did in this movie, I always thought he'd done it in this movie, but he doesn't do the kick over the shoulder. He doesn't do that high kick and hitting somebody in the head that way, even though there's several setups for it.
And again, he does not do the splits, as we mentioned.
Yeah, this is a movie where he's just a fighter. He's not trying to paint himself as the best martial artist in the world. He's just the most talented martial artist on this circuit with the biggest heart that just won't give the fuck up. He won't stay down. And that really works, and it really works well with this week's junk food deep dish.
Yes, for sure.
Where we're wrapping up our JCVD coverage with JCVD. So if you if you guys still could use some more JCBD and want to talk about his most meta film, be sure to jump in and on Patreon and join up so we can talk about that fun one, which is, I mentioned earlier that this is what I think his best meta, his best non-meta film is, because I think JCBD is his best film.
Yeah.
Just hands down. It's just a great fucking film, but it's so very meta. It is so a commentary on things, and there's a lot of depth to it, and there's a really great performance out of Van Damme that is unlike anything else he's done. But this, in terms of just a classic JCBD movie, this is hands down my favorite. I think it's the best of this run.
And I want to say one more thing about the fight sequence. You can feel the shift in decades. This is the third version of Bloodsport, as we've mentioned, of the five that he did.
Is it only the third?
Yes, there was Bloodsport, and then Kickboxer, and then this one.
And which one did, was the one in prison?
Death Warrant was... Okay, so Death Warrant was shot before Lionheart, but released after.
Okay, see, that's what threw me, because I always think of Death Warrant as coming before Lionheart.
It's very strange. It's shot before, released after. But what's interesting is you can feel the shift from the 80s to the 90s in just his Bloodsport knockoffs, because in both of the previous two versions in the 80s, there was that thing that you always saw in 80s martial arts movies where when you get to that signature move, that big moment in the final fight, you don't see it once. You see it 3, 4, 5 times from different angles, but it's the same, you know, blow
do,
being...
Do.
And it happened both in Kickboxer and in Bloodsport. Does not happen in Lionheart.
Yeah, it does.
No, it doesn't. Yeah. You don't see it what hit do you see multiple times?
When Jean-Claude Van Damme is getting hit by Attila, when Attila gives him that big, just catastrophic punch that first puts him out the first time, they edit like four or five times. In fact, Unfiltered Wife has just walked out from her office, and she's nodding going, yes, he totally fucking did.
Ah, well, fuck then. They're all terrible.
I'm sorry. Maybe we'll have to ask Meryl to trim that section.
Never mind. I hate all these movies now.
Great fight, Leo. Your family's going to be okay now. It's time to go home. Let's go.
That brings us to the junk food pairing.
The
junk food pairing, which is not a big box of KFC, because Jesus fucking Christ, Sheldon, somebody should have cut that out. I'm actually going to go with a street burrito. Throughout this movie, Van Damme is eating street food, whether it's a hamburger or, in this case, when he gets to L.A., this amazing-looking burrito that he buys just from a vendor on the side of the road, which is not only part and parcel to a lot of the cuisine that you can get here in Austin, which is stop at any random food truck, even if it's not like in a professional like food truck park, even if it's just a taco place outside of a gas station, believe it or not, makes some amazing dishes.
Well, yeah, but I mean, just a quick sidebar. Did you see what Zagat just put out?
No.
Zagat put out their list of the best cities in the world for eating. Number one is Los Angeles.
Bullshit.
Number two is Austin, Texas.
We should be number one with a bullet.
You know what?
With a diabetic bullet.
You know what? Having gone out on some really stupid business lunches and dinners in LA over the last 7 years, there's some pretty great fucking food. I had a night of sushi that I could not duplicate outside of Los Angeles, except maybe in Japan. Like I've had great sushi here in Austin, but nothing that touches the craziness of what I had in Los Angeles. There's some really great food there, and those people love to fucking eat. They just don't eat a lot. We say, fuck it, we're going to keep eating.
Deep fry the donut and put more stuff on it. That's what we want you to do.
Please deep fry the pickles. Serve it with a little aioli and ranch on the side. We are the number. We beat New York. We beat Hotlanta. We beat all the places that think they are food capitals. Zagat's rated us number two, bitches. So yeah, our street food is officially second to none.
So these to LA. These burritos, the I mean, all of this food that he's eating in this movie, along with the Canadian tuxedo, really emphasized the whole working class thing. I mean, you see like all of the, you know, the fancy penthouses that he ends up staying in because they're where Cynthia lives, and you get a taste for that world, but you really get a taste for what it's like to be blue collar every time he stops at one of these little carts outside of a bodega and has himself a burrito. And you can tell from the bite that he takes, he has no fucking concept of what a burrito is, but he loves it when he has it. And it made me want one so much that I had to make it the junk food.
See, this was I knew this one was going to be tough because I was watching and I was like, does he go with the street burger? Does he go with the burrito? Ding dongs, which were a food in another fucking...
Oh, you said ding dong and I thought you were going to throw me a snack cake because you know that's the official signal now for whenever...
We are out of ding dongs, yo. Ding dongs. We blew through them like the last episode. But you named Ding Dongs the sudden death. Ding Dongs actually appear in this movie, so I'm like, what's he going to do now? I kind of wanted to go ultra meta on it and have that terrible lettuce sandwich that his manager is eating.
What is Joshua eating?
Mr. Joshua is eating a lettuce sandwich. It's literally just bread wrapped around. What I think it is, again, you mentioned he's Shakespearean. And let's just address this from a filmmaking point of view. He's a Shakespearean trained actor, so he's going to get deep into character. He's going to do what's on the page, and if the page says, that's one of the big things about working with
what's on the stage Harrison, actors. What's on the Harrison page, which is the actor's actual name.
There it is. they are very much about, you know, unless there's something actively wrong with what's on the page, you're married to what's on the page and you have to make it work as an actor. That's the theory. And if on the page, it's Joshua is hungrily devouring a sandwich. He knows he's working with Van Damme, who doesn't speak English well. He knows he's going to have to do a lot of takes. What the fuck am I going to eat? Cause I'm going to get full. Cause that's one of the big things. In fact, I kind of got talking to by Ethan Hawke for the dinner scene in Sinister, where he's just like, man, why do you have so many scenes where we eat? Like, it's, you know, you've got us sitting here and we're devouring a whole meal. It's like a 4-page scene at a dinner table. Like, we gotta be eating and there's a lot of food here. So, you know, but that's where I learned, oh shit, you know, if they do 12 takes, especially when they're working with kids, fuck, they're gonna.
That's a lot of lettuce sandwiches.
So, but a lettuce sandwich, a little bit of roughage and some bread, that's not gonna weigh you down as much as if you throw some bacon and mayonnaise and such on it.
So it wasn't a character choice, it was an actor's choice.
I think it was an actor's choice in terms of nobody's gonna notice what I'm eating. So I'm gonna keep biting into the sandwich that's not gonna, you know, take up a lot of room because the lettuce will be mulched down and not take up a lot of space. And I can eat a bunch of lettuce sandwiches without it being too big of a problem. That's my theory. But yeah, he's motherfuckers like eating a lettuce sandwich and passing the bill on to someone else because he doesn't want to pay the clearly 59 cents that a lettuce sandwich fucking costs.
Yes, I'll have a BLT. Hold the B and the T.
Yeah.
How do you even do that? I don't understand. That's going to do it for this week's episode on Leon, on Wrong Bet, on AWOL, on Lionheart.
Motherfucking Lionheart.
Lionheart. So excited that we finally got to talk about this movie and that we are closing out JCV December on the highest of high notes. And then, of course, if you are a patron at the $5 level or higher, you will also get access to the Deep Dish, where we're covering one more. And if you couple that with the commentary that we did for all of our patrons on Kickboxer, we will have officially covered six, count them, six Jean-Claude Van Damme movies in a single month. I could not be happier.
Did we do six or did we do seven?
We did the four main episodes. We are going to do the Deep Dish on JCVD, right, okay, and a commentary, yeah, on Kickboxer.
So that's six JCVD.
I may have miscounted how many times.
And we did not even get to Universal Soldier.
Don't read too much into it. You know what? I may have miscounted the number of times the Hun punches Van Damme in a single shot, but I did not miscount the number of Van Damme movies that we covered in a single month. And speaking of movies and things that we cover in a month, you can always go back and find our back catalog on the Blog Talk Radio Network and on iTunes, and you can follow the show on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema, and of course, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema if you want to get access to all this bonus content. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massaworm, MassaWyrm.
Awesome. You can find me on Twitter at Bryguy Salisbury.
You know what? I also have something else to plug this month, oddly
plug
enough.
Plug.
It's the end of the month. I have been told that I am one of Kindle's Book of the Months books of the month next month. So if you have not picked up your copy of Sea of Rust yet, for those of you that buy digital books through Kindle, you can get it for $1.99. Digitally from Amazon in the month of January. So since this is going up just days before, if you haven't gotten it yet, if you can't throw 2 shekels for a copy of Sea of Rust, Sea of Rust was not for you. So here's your chance. If you're like, oh man, I'm waiting for paperback or it's a little too much, $2, fucking check out the book. I'm dying for you guys to read it.
Now, will Kindle actually accept shekels instead of cash?
That's it depends on which conversion you use.
See, because I don't understand what Bitcoin is, and I'm wondering if shekels are like Bitcoins.
Bitcoin is something for you to pour your money into and then cry a lot and rejoice a lot and then cry again.
Got it. Okay.
It's really just something for people who...
So it's like being a Batman fan.
Yes.
Okay, got it. No, I absolutely can follow you now. That's going to do it for this week's episode, guys, and I want to go out reminding you... Don't ever lose your heart, Lionheart, because you'll never get it back. It's like the McRib. Once it's gone, it's gone. Oh, wait, no, but it's back
for
again.
For 18 months.
Hey, I got my heart back.